These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
That gives me the chills. You're listening to Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. And growing up, my dad loved Star Trek, and I used to watch it with him. I tried understanding because there was something so, magical about the show. I mean, the way it opened and all the sort of technology that they had. And I'm really excited to have in the studio with me actor, director, teacher Walter Koenig, who played Chekhov on Star Trek. This is kind of exciting. I got all like tense because I like the show Star Trek really brings out back a lot of memories for my about my father, who, like I said, adored the show. I lost my father in 2001, and it was just something that for him, I think that he loved the idea of escape. And we also have in the studio with me Mark Cushman, who has written the book These Are the Voyages, and these are three volumes, three thick books, over 600 pages each, that chronicle the evolution of the show, the genesis of the show, every single episode. And I welcome these gentlemen into my studio. Mr. Koenig, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Can we move the microphone down for him a little bit so we make sure that we can hear you? Got to get right up in there. Yeah. Let's see.
Is that better?
That is better. Okay. That is much better. Thank you so much.
I can taste it now.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of weird to get that close. It always impresses me when men, like, there's something about getting close to a microphone because the guys like to kind of, like, lay back and go, yeah, I'm going to talk to you from back here. So I appreciate your indulging me for, like, getting all the way close in there.
Okay.
How many of these interviews do you have to do when to talk about Star Trek? Because people are just fascinated with you, with the impact of the show.
Well, I don't have to do them.
That's true.
And of course, as time goes by, I'm asked less frequently all the time, you know. but it's a pleasure for me to be here tonight on Mark's invitation, because his books that he's written are just so extraordinary. I know there is a danger of sinking into hyperbole, but the fact of the matter is that these are really amazing, amazing chronicles, as you say, that have to be read whether you're a Star Trek fan or not, whether you're a fan of television, whether you want to write, you know, for the medium. They really are a primer in what transpires behind the scenes. And I can't, you know, I would go on and on and on because I am so enthusiastic about this. I have no vested interest other than having written the foreword to one of the volumes. But it's just so marvelous reading. It's just from start to finish, it's just marvelous reading.
How much of what he wrote did you already know? And what kind of surprises did you find in these books?
All through it. Yeah, I didn't know what was going on behind closed doors.
Right.
I didn't know what, you know, was happening, where the animosity was and where the politics were and what what point we were going to be canceled and what the threats were from the network and how the actors were behaving, you know, when the cameras weren't turned on. All of that is quite new to me. I didn't even know that I was in an episode and then they cut me out.
Really? And that was something you learned from Mark's book?
Yes. That's one of the things that I learned from Mark's book, son of a gun.
Oh, my. Yeah, you ruined that for him. His memory of it is totally different, Mark. How did you find out these things? What was going on, the animosity that the Mr. Koenig describes?
You know, it's all in the records that Gene Roddenberry and Bob Justman kept.
Mm-hmm.
These two men knew they were doing something special that had never been done before, so they kept memos on everything. They walked around with dictaphones
mm-hmm.
and put all their thoughts down, and every time they read a script, they would do 20-page memos to each other.
Really?
And everybody on the staff did that. And they kept all this stuff.
How common was that on television shows?
Very not common at all.
Wow.
And for anyone who did keep memos, they'd usually shred them up when the show got canceled.
Okay.
But Gene and Bob said, no, we've got something here that's never been done before. So they
absolutely
documented everything. So when Gene Roddenberry and Bob invited me to wade through all these memos, and there were about 70 boxes of these things, thousands, tens of thousands, all the information's there.
Wow.
And you would see that that Walter was supposed to be in an episode, and Bob Justman would write a memo and say, you know, we can't afford him this week. Because God knows we're paying him too much money.
Lose Chekhov on this episode. Wow.
Well, he had to make it all add up. And so mm-hmm. a lot of times he'd say, we're going to have to do without Uhura on this one.
Right.
Because they would be that tight.
They'd have to make choices as to which actors they wanted to pay for the week. Yeah. Because as soon as you have a line, then you're paid for the episode.
That's right.
Walter, there's someone on the line who has a question for you. We want to talk to. I can't see the. Darlene wants to ask you a question. Darlene is calling from the 773. Hi. What did you want to ask, Walter?
Hi. I read somewhere. First of all, I'm a big fan of Star Trek. But I read that when they hired you in the beginning because you resembled the monkey Davy Jones to encourage more female to watch.
Is that true, that they hired you because you look like Davy Jones?
So is that the question?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Don't ask me where I read it. You know, I'm always reading things I can't delete.
Right.
Well, you're absolutely right. That's exactly why they hired my character. why they wrote my character. In fact, they wrote him initially as an Englishman, as an English cadet, and then decided, Gene Roddenberry very smartly realized that there was something very topical to introduce into the show beyond what they already had, and that was a character who was of Russian extraction, or was Russian, in fact, and at a time when we still were pursuing the Cold War. So it was a very politic move, and at the same time, they wanted somebody who would have the same appeal that Davy Jones had.
Cute. They wanted someone cute.
Okay. Well, you and Mr. Spock were my favorite.
Yeah, we had a lot in common.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Darlene. We appreciate the call. And again, we welcome your phone calls at 312-981-7200. When else are you going to talk to Chekhov? I'm just saying. And to the ultimate historian of the Star Trek series, Mark Cushman. It's fascinating. I mean, my husband, when I called him and said I was going to talk to him, he's like, oh, you know, I read that there were only two actors that were actually up for the role. Is that accurate as well?
That is absolutely accurate. There's only two actors. The other actor was a fellow that I had actually done an episode of a series called Jericho back in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And we played French resistance fighters. So we were the only two actors to read. And so
you had a 50-50 shot. How's that feel?
Which is, it's amazing.
Yes.
It's amazing. When you consider what this show has gone on to be, you know, the circumstances under which I got the part were so contrary to what somebody you might think would have to pursue. You know, coming in, you read, they shoot you, they put you on film, they send the film to the producer, to the director, they have to okay it, then it goes to the network at all. And I got the part the same day that I read.
What? I didn't know that part.
Yeah, well, the interesting part about that, and then I'm not going to say another word unless we're talking about Mark Cushman.
Yes, I know. I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, I got to get Mark in here. We will.
I love this story.
Yes.
Well, after reading and sitting there, because they didn't tell me, they told me not to leave. This literally, the sun began to go down, and there was nobody there. Everybody had left. And then somebody came up to me and said, "Are you Walter Koenig?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, "Come with me." And he was very perfunctory about it. And not very personal, and I went over to the wardrobe room, and my hand to God, if I believed in such things, he dropped to his knees in front of me, put his hand on my crotch, and I said, what are you doing? And then I saw the tape measure in his other hand.
Yeah.
I'm measuring you for a costume. You're playing Chekhov. And that's how I found out that I was on Star Trek.
That's such a surprising way to find out, with a man holding you.
Yeah, holding you by the nuts.
Holding jewels. Oh, no. Wow. Were there any other actors that had a similar experience, Mark?
Well, the wardrobe man that did all the costumes was Bill Tice.
Uh-huh.
And Bill Tice was gay, and he was openly gay.
Okay.
And but I think Walter was the only one he went for, so it must have been that Davy Jones.
That Davy Jones thing. We might as well take your chances. And Mark, now you had all these transcripts, all the records that were compiled by the creators of the series. How much did you, you know, like, you have to filter some of that out, and you also have to frame it, because you also have, you know, the way this sort of evolved and how it ended up coming to network. I had no idea that Lucille Ball was involved in Star Trek. I don't, I, I, I've, I've checked the corners of my brain. That does not spark any memories. How was Lucille Ball involved?
Well, she owned Desilu Studios. She was the president of Desilu Studios. She and Ricky started that studios off of the rerun money that they made off of I Love Lucy.
Okay.
And she was looking for another property that could go like I Love Lucy did. She said, we need something that can just rerun for decades.
And okay, she, so that she, was the intention, was to have something like that.
She spotted that in Star Trek. She said, this is different enough and unique enough and special enough where it might rerun for 10 years, who knows. And the board of directors didn't want to do it. They said, this is going to be too expensive. We are not a big enough studio. This will bankrupt us. So she really took a chance on that show and sadly lost. She was right, but she lost because she had to sell to Paramount. They ran out of money.
Oh, no. Well, that's the thing. Maybe it was too different. I don't, were there any other sci-fi shows before Star Trek? Lost in Space.
That was the only other one. You'd had Twilight Zone and Outer Limits, but those were anthology series.
Every story was different.
Yeah.
And this was a chronological. Well, not chronological, because it's so episodic. The things that they came across and the situations that they put you in were so, it was out of this world. And literally, that's what the show was about. When we come back, I'm going to ask our caller, Carl, to hold on. We're going to take a break and come back. We're talking to Mark Cushman, who has written the book, well, not the book, but the three books about each season of the three seasons of Star Trek called These Are the Voyages. They're available at Amazon.com. And you also have the website, thesearethevoyages.com.
These are the Voyages books.
Yes, make sure we put that on there. And we're also talking to Walter Koenig, who played Chekhov on the series Star Trek. We'll be right back after this on Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez, live in Los Angeles. And I'm broadcasting from Los Angeles, 720 WGN, and I have in studio with me the author, actually the writers of These Are the Voyages. I have Mark Cushman in studio with me and Susan Osborne. Is it Osborne? See someone's name and you don't want to, butcher it. There's always some slight differences. And we also have in studio with us Walter Koenig, who played Chekhov on Star Trek. And, it's one of those things where we can't imagine our lives without Star Trek now. It has had such an impact on so much of our lives. Even the imagination for the technology that they had on the show. Yeah, it was.
If you have a cell phone, then Star Trek has affected your life.
Yeah, exactly. It is. It's one of those things. It's not just we think of it as just film and television, and even on Big Bang Theory. But cell phones. The next thing you know, we'll be teleporting. Who knows?
Oh, I hope so. With Los Angeles traffic, you bet.
I don't know. Have you seen The Fly? It doesn't look like things go well when you try to. It just seems like a really big mess. And how did he think of this? How did Gene how did he come up with this story?
Because he was producing a series right before Star Trek called The Lieutenant, mm-hmm. and it got canceled because he did an episode on racism in the military. And so he decided the only way he could tell the type of stories he wanted to was to stage them on other worlds, kind of like Gulliver's Travels.
Right.
So he could do stories about Vietnam. He could do stories about racism and sexism and all those type of things. You have to remember, in the 1960s, you had the entertainment division and the news division on network TV. And you weren't allowed to talk about politics or sex on the entertainment division. So he tricked it by making it happen on other planets.
Right. So if you take it, put it in fantasy, it's not an attack to the culture that we imagine it as.
Right.
It is.
Yeah. Do you remember the episode of the guys that were half white and half black?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
You couldn't have done that on any other show.
No, it has to be in the realm of fantasy. We also have a caller who's been waiting for a little bit. Carl had a question, or actually had something that he wanted to kind of toss into the conversation. Carl is calling from the 262. How are you doing, Carl?
Hey, Patty. You have a great show. I just found it by accident because I had insomnia and I have been listening every night. Come back to Chicago, but good luck with the movie, really.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. Yes.
Science fiction has some really bad writers in it, but three of the best writers to ever work in science fiction television worked on Star Trek. Harlan Ellison, the god of the short story. David Gerrold, the guy who wrote the Tribbles episode. And Dorothy Fontana, who did everything else. That's my comment, and I love Walter Koenig, man. And I'm looking at the book that you guys put together on Amazon, and I'm not a Trekkie, but this thing looks fantastic.
It really is. I mean, because it's a historical document. What he's done is he's made it.
I know, and I love this kind of stuff. I'm one of those guys who will sit through the credits and memorize them on
Me too.
On, on anything that I like. It's, you know, movie, documentary, television, and I don't like a whole lot. But
why do you do that, Carl? I know why I do it. I like to sit there and watch the credits because I like to see the people that have put the work into it. Why do you do that?
Yes. Yeah, yes, because, for one, I write. Two, there's nothing without a script. I don't care what you have. You can put it, the best actors in the world on stage, but if you give Laurence Olivier, the late, great Laurence Olivier, a bad script, you're going to have a bad play.
Right. Right. That's
You know, I don't care what you do with it. You can have Spielberg direct it. You can have Scorsese direct it. It's, you know, junk is junk. If it's junk on the paper, it's going to be junk on the screen. Harlan Ellison, David Gerald, and Dorothy Fontana all wrote for Star Trek. What a gift.
Well, there you go. Thank you so much, Carl, and I'm glad you found the show. All right? I hope I'm not keeping you up too late, so get some rest, will you, at some point?
If it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage.
That's right.
That's right.
Star
Trek actually had a lot of famous science fiction writers. Theodore Sturgeon, mm-hmm. Robert Bloch, Richard Matheson. I mean, they brought them in. Even Ray Bradbury was going to write for them, but his story, they couldn't get on the air. It was too big for television back then.
Well, what kind of background did Roddenberry have that he wanted to tell these stories that were politically and socially charged and had to find a realm for them in fantasy?
Gene was a rebel. And he liked to shake up the system at the networks. And there's why Star Trek got into trouble with NBC. It wasn't the ratings. As you'll find in the book here, you see the ratings for every episode. The first episode of Star Trek had a 47% audience share.
That's crazy.
It was a massive hit.
What was that like as an actor on the show? I mean, did you have the effects of that, of trying to be in public, Walter?
Well, for one thing, I didn't come on the show till the second season.
Mm-hmm.
And by then, our ratings were... We were okay, but we were fairly insulated from all of that. I think Mark implies as much that the network didn't want us to know how well the show was doing for purposes of negotiation, etc. So we always felt that we were sort of, you know, on the edge, that we could be canceled at any time, and that. It did not feel like a hit show. Certainly our audience was vociferous and ambulatory and very passionate, but we were sort of brainwashed into believing that we were marginal.
Oh, that it wasn't going that well.
Yeah.
I have a caller. I have Linda that wanted to tell us. She was living in...
Hi, Patty. You've talked to me before. I've called you before, but I wanted to say hello to Mr. Koenig. And I lived in Los Angeles in the mid-80s. I'm from Chicago. I'm back now. But I met you at Sears in North Hollywood when I worked there.
Oh.
And I talked to you. And I've been a Star Trek fan since I was 13 in high school. And my friends and I used to take turns going to each other's house and having pizza parties and watching Star Trek.
Oh, what a great memory.
And I also... Yes, it's wonderful. I also used to watch it with my father. He should rest in peace as well, who I miss like crazy. He was a scientist. And my mother never got Star Trek, even though later on she would watch it with me. She'd go, what did they do that for?
Right.
Why did they do that?
Yeah, my mom was always kind of like, what's the point of this show?
You know, and then she'd let me know, oh, Linda, this person from Star Trek is on this TV show. You want to come and see it? So, you know,
right.
And I didn't always have the best relationship with her, but, you know, she did think about me and some of the things that I loved when I was a kid that I still love.
Right.
And,
oh, there you go.
Patty.
Oh, I didn't do that. Somebody else did that.
You know, I
hope I didn't do that. Sorry, Linda. Yes.
I just wanted to fill in that void for a moment. When you say, what was the point of Star Trek? I think ultimately... And forgive my lyricism, is that it did exactly what she was talking about. It brought families together. People come up to me all the time at conventions and say, I watched this with my dad.
Right.
I watched this with my mom. You know, and that's a very keen memory for them.
It is.
Adopted family, your friends, you know, people outside of your nuclear family. And I just want to say, I shall be and always have been your friend.
Bless your heart.
There you go. There you go. Thank you so much, Linda. Have a lovely lovely evening. We'll talk to you again soon. We are talking to Mark Cushman and Susan Osborne, who have written the book, These Are the Voyages, that chronicle the every episode of the three seasons of Star Trek. We are talking to Walter Koenig, who played Chekhov. And I hope that you'll hang out with me for a little bit longer, because I have to go take care of a break right now. I mean, I have to take care of that, but also some stuff with WGN in Chicago. You're listening to Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. I'm in Los Angeles. This is Patty Vasquez, and I'm broadcasting live from Los Angeles, and I am honored to have in studio with me several people who are involved in talking about the Star Trek series. We have Mark Cushman and Susan Osborne, who have written the book These Are the Voyages, which chronicle... I'm just holding out. Wait, hold on a second. That's a really heavy book. It's over 600 pages, and this one book chronicles just the first season, the evolution, the genesis of the show, every single episode, the drama that went on behind the scenes. First of all, just to get the show on the air, and then episode by episode of the struggle that they had with what was going to be on the air. And this book has recently won the Saturn Award, which was the biggest sci-fi awards in film and television, in literature. And this is exciting. You deserve this, because there isn't anybody else who, I can't think of any other series. And I know that I see over here that there's another book about I Spy, which was a culturally significant show, mm-hmm. in how it broke down barriers for African Americans on television. And this is really a tribute to a show that has had such an impact on us culturally. And also joining us is Walter Koenig, who played Chekhov, and is doing a work right now. He's doing an indie comedy called Nobility, and has a graphic novel he's written out right now called Things to Come from Blue Water Comics. And I don't want to ignore Sue. I know that Sue's got an adorable dog in her lap and no microphone near her, and I don't want to ignore you. And I feel bad too, because when I don't have headphones for you, because we have a caller on the line from the 630. We have Joe, who wanted to chime in on the conversation. Hey, Joe.
Yeah. Hey, Patty. How you doing?
Hey, Pumpkin. How you doing?
Good. Listen, hey, the fascination with Star Trek is well-deserved. It dates back to JFK, Kennedy, if you will. The hopes and aspirations that people had in that era for space travel, my God, we landed the first guy on the moon. Fast forward to today, NASA's being eviscerated by our current administration. People like Fermilab, you know, they're in Chicago. Their budget for research has been cut back just utterly disastrously. You know, scientists that we need for future development of space, in the atom, the whole nine yards.
Right, right.
Are being cut just, you know, drastically. It saddens me, put it that way.
I agree.
But nevertheless, the Star Wars fascination is well deserved.
Star Trek. Yeah, watch it. Watch it, Joe. You better back up. Yeah, Chekhov just fired one across the bow.
Adios, kiddo.
Thanks, Joe. The elements that came into play, and Mr. Koenig, you said that you came in the second season when the show was kind of established, but even then they kind of insulated the cast as to how successful you were becoming. What was it like to jump in on a show that was already in progress?
Well, I was just very happy that I had a payday.
Sure.
You know, that most weeks I was working. So I didn't have a contract. It was just a week-by-week thing, and they'd see whether they could use me or not, and whether the fan reaction was. I didn't even know that George Takei wasn't available because he was shooting on another film. And, of course, that led to a lot of my opportunities. Because George was busy doing another picture with John Wayne, he wasn't there to do the parts that he would have done. Mm-hmm. So they gave him the Chekhov instead. But, you know, it was... I did not see the forest for the trees. I was there just to work.
Sure.
And to try to get the accent reasonable. And
were there pressures for you to do the accent a particular way?
No, not until the show was well into syndication. Years and years later, was I told that I had done a really rotten job.
What?
But that notwithstanding, it was really just another gig
right.
for me. It didn't sink in until we went into syndication, mm-hmm. and began to see, you know, how much appeal this show really had, and which, by the way, to segue in the most elegant way, this book has.
Mm-hmm.
This book has enormous appeal.
It does. It really does. Well, and that's what I wanted to ask Mark. You had mentioned, and as Mr. Koenig has alluded to, is, you know, while they're in the, everyone's in the thick of it, you can't see the trees, the individual elements that go into that storytelling. You know, to me, Dr. Spock and the way he sort of, you know.
Did you say Dr. Spock?
What was it?
Mr. Spock.
Wasn't it Doctor?
No,
who was Dr. Spock? Oh, that's the book, the baby
doctor.
Books. Yeah. I'm sorry. It's late and I'm in a different time zone. Spock. Let's just go with Spock.
Okay.
How's that? Is that easier?
Yes,
yeah, Spock. Yes, yeah, Spock is much easier. Sorry about that. Wow. Everybody just like, I can feel the energy of like, you have no idea what you're talking about. I have some idea. No, the way, I mean, because of the sort of detachment that he had and the way he could observe and make commentary, I think was also very eloquent and used as a tool by Roddenberry to.
It was brilliant.
Yes.
I mean, to put in an alien who's observing mankind, observing all of our faults and weaknesses, allowed us to see ourselves as somebody else might.
Right.
And nobody had done that on TV before, so it was a very good way to examine the human element.
Well, and it's used, and that is used over and over again. The way he did that is now used, whether it's a character on Big Bang Theory. I mean, you sort of have that person that gets to be that voice, and you can't get mad at him because that's just who he is. And to me, Spock was sort of the genesis of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And NBC didn't want Mr. Spock in the show. They were afraid the Southern affiliates.
They thought he should have been a doctor. That's why.
Yeah. They didn't think the Southern affiliates would have carried the show because he was too satanic looking.
Oh, really?
You know? Yeah. And as you'll find in book two there, Nimoy almost didn't make it back to the show for the second season.
Because of the Southerners?
No, because his popularity exploded.
Really?
He was getting so much fan mail that his agent said, wait a minute, he has to get a raise. He's only making $1,200 an episode.
Right.
And so he almost didn't come back. And it was NBC who said, no, you got to bring him back. The ones who didn't want him in the first place.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. See, and that's the thing is that Mr. Koenig, you said that you didn't even know about a lot of the drama that was going on behind the doors in these negotiations. Was there a point, like in the third season, where you went, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here before the end? Was there sort of a sense of, you know, we're really successful, we deserve more?
Well, I do remember that in I had a long meeting with Gene in the summer. Or between season two and season three, I went to his home, and he read me some memos that he had sent to Schlosser and Werner, who were the big cheeses at NBC, about how they were going to elaborate on Chekhov and how they were going to get him more involved in going down to the planet and having girlfriends and the romance and the whole thing. And I went away from that feeling just great. I thought, you know, this is going to be really a wonderful, wonderful experience for me. And then one day, Jimmy, George, and I were doing a layout for a magazine, I think it was called Fave, and we were on horseback.
Okay.
What could be more sublime for preteens than Star Trek actors on horseback, you know?
Davy Jones lookalike on horseback.
Nice, no less.
And somehow somebody got the word and passed it on to us as we were sitting there for this photo op, that we had been switched from 8 o'clock Monday to 10 o'clock Friday or Saturday. Which was it?
Friday night, the death
really?
Slot.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, and as soon as I heard that, I said, that's it. We're done.
Wow.
We're done. I knew we were done. They had given up. They capitulated. They had, whatever had happened, we were in a time zone that would not be viable for our audience.
It was a death spiral.
Particularly, you know, my audience, my little kids, the kids who write in pencil and on lined paper, they'd be in bed, and the teens and older were off having dates on Friday night. So I knew then that we were in trouble. And then when you got on the set and you saw the things that were going on, there was just a lack of the energy and a lack of the enthusiasm that we had. Prior, there was this death knell, this pall that had come over the set. Only Jimmy Doohan said, we were coming back. We're coming back for four. And he was absolutely adamant about it. And I admired him for such optimism in the face of what really seemed to be a very dire situation, particularly when we hired an attorney who sits in an office and writes contracts to play the guest lead in the episode. And he was so awful.
Yeah.
Now, children, we are going to do this.
Melvin Belli and the children shall lead.
Yeah. Oh, what a mess.
Yeah, it was a mess. And it was very demoralizing. It was extremely demoralizing. Because I knew. I said, that's it. We're done. It's over.
Wow. Well, we're gonna when we come back, I want to ask Mark about what happened between Roddenberry and NBC and how the series ended and then came back as movies. You're listening to Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. I'm live from Los Angeles.
It makes me homesick. Just like Russia.
More like the Garden of Eden, Ensign.
Of course, Doctor. The Garden of Eden was just outside Moscow.
That's Walter Koenig as Chekhov, and he's in studio with me right now. And is that now? Are there moments from the series that you remember more than others, more favorably, or you know? My husband asked me about the OK Corral. I think there was a where you got shot. I believe. Does that sound familiar? That's his favorite, and he wanted me to ask you about that.
Well, I like that movie. That episode. Yeah, I thought it was necessity is the mother of invention. We were low. Our budget was low on that. We didn't have a lot of money to spend. So they built these sets that were, more symbolic than real.
Right.
I mean, they didn't have backs. They were just, and it somehow really added to the whole sense of the wonder and the mystery of the show. It was curious. It really was a positive in a situation where it could have appeared to be a negative. But to answer your question, yes, there is one line that I remember more than any other, and that's "Aye, aye, sir," because I said it so many times.
That's wonderful. Aye, aye, sir. we are talking to Walter Koenig, who played Chekhov in the series Star Trek and in the movies. And right now he has a book, a graphic novel he wrote that's out right now called Things to Come from Blue Water Comics. And he's working on an indie comedy called Nobility. And we're also joined in studio by Susan Osborne and Mark Cushman, who have written the book These Are the Worlds. These are the Worlds. These are the Voyages. And I'm looking at the stars. I'm like, that's another world. These are the Voyages. And there are three volumes available on Amazon.com and their website, theseofthevoyagesbooks.com. Mm-hmm. And these are really fascinating looks and glimpses into the history of a series that has had so much of an impact on our culture. What happened between NBC and Gene Roddenberry?
It was a bad marriage. They just didn't get along. Gene Roddenberry wanted to tell stories NBC didn't want to have on the air, not in prime time. And so they kept trying to censor him, and the more you tried to censor Gene Roddenberry, the more determined he was going to tell these stories. And you have to also remember, Star Trek introduced the miniskirt to America.
Right.
NBC didn't want to see that much leg.
And an African-American woman in a position of power.
Yeah, yeah. And Nichelle Nichols and Grace Lee Whitney used to hike their skirts up to try to outdo each other, who could show more leg.
Nice.
On that show. So there was just, the show was a little hot to handle for that period. And that's why they kept trying to hide it and finally put it on in the death slot of Fridays from 10 to 11, where everybody knew it was going to die.
And obviously it's a different time of history for televisions and networks. But with the kinds of numbers they were getting, though, nobody else, I mean, there wasn't a moment where they could have gone somewhere else. I mean, it's just a three, I guess.
Paramount didn't want to shop it. They could have easily shopped it after the third season when NBC said no more.
Mm-hmm.
They could have taken it to ABC or CBS. As a matter of fact, a couple of years later, both ABC and CBS wanted it, and NBC wanted it back. But the problem was it was costing too much.
Right.
Even though, as Walter says, they had to scrimp to get it made because they were doing half a science fiction movie each week.
Right.
But Star Trek was the second most expensive series being produced on TV. The most expensive, you have that book right there.
Right, I Spy. Yeah.
Because it was filming around the world. So it was a lot of money, and Paramount thought, we're never going to recoup this.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just pull the plug and get rid of it before we go broke like Desilu did.
Wow. Yeah, I can't imagine having those kinds of numbers now that somebody would want to pick. I mean, because those are dream numbers now. Those are fantasy numbers, literally.
Sure, sure.
47%.
That was one
share,
episode.
47 share.
Yeah, the one
but
episode
still,
in the first season.
How the advertising now you could sell for, if you could say that,
yeah.
I mean, everyone would want
yeah,
that.
Yeah, the first season averaged 31% audience share for the whole year. Second season was 27.9. Third season was 28.1. Even in the death slot, 28% of the TVs in America were tuned to Star Trek, and it wasn't good enough.
That's unimaginable. And Kevin, my writing partner Kevin, was telling a story today when we were at a meeting about Uhura, who was going to catch the actress wanted to leave the show after the first season.
Right.
And what kept her from leaving?
Martin Luther King.
Well, wait. Yeah. How do you not leave then?
Well,
how did that happen?
You know, the only two shows at that time that were showing blacks in non-stereotypical way was I Spy with Bill Cosby,
mm-hmm.
and Star Trek. And so she was at a fundraising event, and she had already told Roddenberry she was going to leave the series because she had a singing career she wanted to get back to and so forth, and she didn't feel her parts were big enough, and she might as well go back to singing. And he came up to meet her, and he said, "I'm one of your biggest fans." And she said, "Well, thank you, but I'm leaving the show." And he said, "You cannot, because you show us what our people can be in the future."
Right. Oh, wow. I mean, what a great statement, and accurate, too, because, you know, even for me growing up, my mother is from Mexico, there were very few, images of women that were outside of being maids. And to be a little girl in the 60s and see a woman who was an officer, you know, in the future, that is, I mean, an incredible thing.
Yeah. Or a Russian.
Or Russian, for that matter, yeah, as a friend, right, during the Cold War. So after the series ended, how did it come back as movies?
You know, NBC wanted to bring it back almost the moment they canceled it. because after they canceled it, within a couple months, Man Walked on the Moon. And Mort Werner made a statement to the press in September of 69, just as Star Trek was leaving the network, that maybe we'll do a movie in a year or two, and maybe every couple of years we'll do a movie for the network. Well, in 1972, NBC was trying to bring the series back. But at that point, and people don't know this, but it's all in these books and you see the memos, but at that point, the cast was all over the place. Nimoy was working on Mission Impossible, and everybody, you couldn't get them back together, and that's why they did the animated version. Because they could record the voices and put them into the show.
And do they use the original actors from the series?
Yeah, okay. Original actors and original writers, and it won an Emmy. The Saturday morning animated version from 1973 through 75.
Wow.
It was the only way to bring them back, and at that time they were negotiating to do the first movie. Walter can tell you it just took a lot of years to get that movie done.
Yeah, I mean, what was the process like to hear that, like sort of the rumblings of, we're going to make a movie? I mean, at what point do you go, whatever?
Almost from the beginning.
Really?
Because the intervals between those promises were fairly short.
Okay.
And so just as you would get to a place where you're really excited about making a movie, then they tell you, no, we're not going to make a movie. I mean, we had one time when we were called to the wardrobe to be measured for costumes. And the wardrobe person said to me, you know, wow, you certainly have kept fit. You know, you'll be able to use your costume without any problem, the one that you had. Because they were going to use the old costumes. They were going to use the...
Oh, no.
And this is absolutely true. I'm not exaggerating. I got home. The phone was ringing. We're not going to make this movie, after all. I mean, just having been told we were going to make it, then came back, we're not going to do it. We're not going back into production. And that happened... Ad infinitum, ad nauseum. And after a while, you just say, it's never going to happen.
Sure.
It's never going to happen. We had a breakfast at Paramount Studio with all the journalists. They came in from all over the country. And Bill Shatner introduced each of us. Of course, he couldn't remember my name.
I was going to say, I don't even know how much I want to ask you about Chico. Shatner. I know.
Couldn't remember my name. It was a perfect point. For where I should have jumped up and said, this is what I've been talking about! But I didn't. In any case, then we didn't, you know, and we had a start date then, and we didn't follow through. And there were myriad reasons for all of this happening. A lot of them had to do with economics. They had to do with the special effects company they were trying to get to work with us. But it went on and on, and the day we actually started, I didn't believe we were going to shoot this film until the second shot.
Oh, right, after they started filming, as soon as they say cut once, you're like, maybe, I'm going to wait for the next cut.
Well, the second shot was Kirk coming on the bridge, and Michelle, George, and I, and Jimmy running over to him. And when we set up for that, we said, okay, cut, let's set this shot up. Then I looked at the others, and I saw Bill, and I said, we're going to make this movie.
Wow.
And that's when I knew we were going to make it. And I was ecstatic. In fact, I think I had to change my pants.
And the tailor wasn't there to help you with that?
No, he wasn't there to grab my crotch. No.
No, nowhere near your crotch. We have been talking to Walter Koenig, who has played Chekhov in the series and the movie Star Trek, and to the writers of the book, These Are the Voyages, Mark Cushman and Susan Osborne. And these books are available on Amazon.com. They've recently won the Saturn Awards, which is one of the most prestigious sci-fi awards for television, film, and literature. And I really urge you to to take a look at these books. If you want to know not just about Star Trek, but about the history of television, what it took to get a series on a network, and the struggle to keep it on the network, and how the whole thing collapsed, being one of the most successful television shows in history. It's really a great documentation of that, and I thank you so much. Thank you so much, Susan. I didn't even get a chance to ask you. She's like, I didn't want you to. And again, thank you, Mark. Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Walter. It's been a pleasure to meet you, and I look forward to talking to you again. I think we should do this whenever, if you have time and you'll indulge me, I would love to do it.
Whenever you're in L.A.
Or you gotta come to Chicago in the middle of winter.
Okay.
or during Cubs season. Either way, it's kind of drastic. You're listening to Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez, 720 WGN.